10, 11, and 12 of Daniel stand as separate chapters. But these chapter divisions are slightly artificial because in the original Hebrew there are no chapter divisions. It's just all one long story without breaks. And yet I think that these three chapter divisions are helpful to us because they do represent three different phases in the story. Chapter 10, which we looked at last Sunday, is the prelude to the vision proper. And in chapter 10, we have Daniel's encounter with the glorious man. Chapter 11 this evening is the vision proper. And it's the preview of the history between the testaments, between the end of the Old Testament and the beginning of the New Testament, a period of roughly 400 years. In chapter 12, which we'll study next Sunday, we come to the last things, the general resurrection and the separation of men's destinies after the last judgment. Now, I'd like you to see that in these three chapters, 10, 11, and 12, there is in fact a pattern of truth being established. In chapter 10, you see a man at prayer, and the greater part of chapter 10 is taken up with Daniel's great prayer. He is in anguish before God, and the circumstances of his times have driven him to prayer. You must remember now that Daniel is an old man, probably in his 80s. In chapter 1 of the book, he's a teenager. But now, 70 or 80 years have passed, and he's an old man, and he's burdened. And the burden of his prayer is this: Lord, the time has come for you to do something. The time has come for your promises to come true. The time has come for you to be true to your word. For 70 years, we have been in Babylon for our sins. Back in Jerusalem, the walls of Zion are not yet built. Back in Jerusalem, the building of the temple is terribly slow. Now we are your people, and we are called by your name, Lord. Time has come for you to do something. That's Daniel 10. Next week we'll come to Daniel 12, which is the vision of the last things, the great tribulation before the end of the age, the resurrection of the dead, the resurrection of the saved, and the resurrection of the damned, the last judgment, heaven and hell. That's chapter 12. And in between 10 and 12, you have this difficult chapter, 11, with its complex history. Now, this is the pattern. What you have in these three chapters is three kinds of travail. In chapter 10, you have the travail of prayer. Was it Augustine who said, orare est laborare? In other words, to pray is to work. Or it can be translated, to work is to pray. Of course, it's only a half-truth. You mustn't substitute work for prayer. There are people who don't pray because their lives are busy, 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 busy. We should also not substitute prayer for work. There are people who are so busy praying, they have no time to do anything for Christ. Orare est laborare. But one thing is absolutely certain. Prayer is hard work. That's why so many people never engage in it. That's why so many Christians start it and then give up. Because it's jolly hard work. The travail of prayer. In chapter 11 this evening, we have the travail of history. Wars and rumors of war, political machinations, all the cunning and the deceit of the world of politics, suffering human beings, suffering refugees, the turmoil and the confusion of men and nations. That's what chapter 11 was about. Travail of history. And next week, chapter 12, the travail of the end, the birth pangs of the new creation, just as a woman goes into labor when she's bringing forth a child into the world. So the universe, according to the scripture, is going to go into labor and travail to bring forth a new heaven and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. The travail of the end. Let me put it this way. The three chapters. Chapter 10, the agony of prayer. Chapter 11 this evening, the agony of history. Chapter 12 next week, the agony of the end. Now, that seems to be a pattern of truth here. And I'd like us to look at chapter 11 more closely now. Obviously, it is an extremely complicated chapter. That's stating the obvious, surely. But it may encourage you to learn that all these difficult and complex details that I gave on the sheet are not the real point of the chapter. I hope you find that a comfort. You see, if that's all there is in the chapter, just telling history before it happens, just recording events, if that's all the chapter's about, then there's no message in the chapter. It's just telling you facts. You simply read it and you say, oh yes, this is the wars, this is the story of the wars between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. That's all that the chapter is. It's just history. But what we are called on to do as Christians is to come to all of this and extract abiding principles and abiding lessons that hold true in every age, not just in those days when the king of the north was fighting the king of the south and the king of the south fighting the king of the north, and they were trying to arrange alliances and peace pacts and political marriages, but abiding principles and abiding lessons that hold true in every age and can help us from day to day in our Christian lives. And I believe that if we come to the complexities of Daniel 11 in that spirit, we can draw out lessons that last for Christians for all time. And it's possible for us to draw immense strength and help here. Now I want to pick out three important lessons from this difficult chapter. The first great lesson is this. Our God is marching on. In all this confusion of wars and battles and treachery and intrigues, God was marching on to the coming of Christ. God is marching in history. I like the comment of Professor J.S. Whale, that fine Christian theologian and historian. And Whale said, history is God's roaring loom. Shuttle. It's whizzing. The threads whizzing. The warp and the woof, they're all whizzing. God's roaring loom. You see, Whale believes that history has a meaning. Do you believe that history has a meaning? Or do you just live a day at a time, a week at a time, a month at a time, a year at a time? Whale says, yes, there is a meaning. But another theologian says, no, I don't know whether he's a Christian or not. I was amazed to read these words from Reinhold Niebuhr. The solution to history is that there is no solution. No solution. No hope. No meaning. Are we condemned to chaos and confusion and war forever and ever and ever? No solution. What about the second coming of Christ? Isn't that a solution? What disturbs me about Niebuhr's statement that there's no solution is this, that it's the sort of thing the enemies of God are saying in our very lifetime. It's what the nihilists are saying. They are the people who believe in nothing. Nihil, nothing. Hegel, last century, a German heretic, infidel, once said, the message of history is that men do not learn the message of history. And the nihilists today would say, no, Mr. Hegel, you're wrong. You're assuming that history has a message and that men are not learning it. We say there is no message to learn. History is meaningless. History is nonsense. There is no message in history. That's why some of them live such immoral lives. You see, if that's true, you can live as rotten and unbelieving a life as you like. You can live as godless a life as you like, if there's no last judgment, if there's nothing at the end of the road. And the Marxists are saying the same thing, and they're not few. Left-wing infiltration, Trotskyites and all that, if you listen to the news. See, the Marxists say there is no voice of God in the affairs of men. How can there be, since there's no God? If there's no God, how can there be a voice of God? Instead, they say, the wheels of history are oiled with secular oil. Men are hungry. Hungry men need food. To get food, you need money. To get money, you need work. But if work is controlled by capitalists, then men are victims of the capitalist system, and therefore the real answer is one for all and all for one. Brotherhood, you know. Brotherhood without Christ. Isn't it pathetic to hear all these men at the big conferences speaking about brother so-and-so and brother so-and-so, and they would chop each other's heads off if they got the chance. There is no brotherhood outside Christ. One for all and all for one. That's history, and they find it idealized in a communist state. But they say, apart from that, there's no meaning in history. There are even people who believe the old pagan view of history. If you remember our studies in elementary doctrine in the mornings, about 2 years ago, the old heathen view that history goes round in circles. Just keeps repeating itself. There's no meaning. It just goes round. The Greeks called it Genesis, Hubris, Nemesis. Genesis, the nation is born. Hubris, the nation becomes proud. Nemesis, the nation ends in judgment and chaos. Genesis, Hubris, Nemesis. That process repeats itself in history over and over and over and over again, not just in nations, but in families. Families are born, families become proud, families fall under judgment. It's true of churches as well. Churches are born, churches grow, churches disappear. It's true of ministries. Ministries are born, ministries grow, ministries disappear. Circle after circle, wheel after wheel, the meaninglessness of history. What does the Bible say? We've just been singing it, rather timidly. God is working his purpose out as year succeeds to year. And the purposes of God in the gospel of Christ and in the church of Christ are not circles, but a straight line. That's what Ezekiel saw in chapter 1 of his book. The chariot throne of Jehovah, the wheels within wheels, and the throne moving in a straight line across the sky, not deflecting to the left or to the right. The wheels of history turn, but they are the wheels of the chariot throne of God, and they turn to carry God's work and God's people and God's purposes forwards. I say, doesn't this excite you and thrill you in this troubled world of the 1980s? That everything that happens in history is for the glory of Christ and for the glory of the church. That's what's going to be at the end of the road. A glorified church in heaven. Doesn't that excite you? Afghanistan is no problem to God. Iran is no problem to God. Andrei Sakharov, that's no problem to God. Wasn't it lovely to see him sitting there in his flat in Moscow before they removed him to Gorky, with a cross on the wall behind him, a plain cross without a figure on it. That's no problem to God. Jesus said that tribulation was the mark of the age. History has always gone on like this. But in the history, and through the history, and over the history. Our God is marching on. In Daniel 11, God was marching on to the coming of Christ. We are now marching on to the second coming of Christ. God is marching on. Jesus in his lifetime despaired that the churchy people could not discern the signs of the times. Can you discern the signs of the times? Can you see history with the eyes of God? Do you watch your television screens with the eyes of God? Or is it just a secular thing to you? Secular men, secular wars, secular arguments, secular politics. Is that all you see with your eyes when you watch the television? God help you. If you watch with the eyes of Christ, you'll see God on the move. Second thing is this. In all the turmoil of secular history, one of the things that Christians need to guard against is compromise. I wonder if you noticed the mention throughout the reading of the glorious land, the covenant, the people of the covenant. The glorious land, of course, is Palestine, God's country, God's work, God's people. The covenant is the bond between God and his people. It's the covenant of grace. And there are also hints here that some of the people inside the land and inside the covenant compromised themselves and sold themselves to the oppressors and took sides with the secular powers. Listen to these words. Armies shall be utterly swept away from before him and broken, and the prince of the covenant also, Onias, the priest who wanted to be true to God, whatever it cost him. And he was deposed. Listen to these words. He shall return to his land with great substance, but his heart shall be set against the people of the Holy Covenant. Here's a man against the work of God. Listen to these words. He shall be enraged and take action against the Holy Covenant. Here's a secular man who is against the work of God. Listen to these words. He shall seduce with flattery those who violate the covenant. In other words, what the enemies of God are trying to do is cultivate yes men, people in the church who will toe the party line and bow the knee to Caesar, people who sell themselves to the enemies of God and who compromise their Christian position. Did you know that in Russia and in every country of Eastern Europe there are two churches? There's the official church, the state church, recognized by the regime, controlled, manipulated. And there's the other church, free, independent, persecuted, uncompromised, and unregistered. And that would happen in Britain if ever an extreme government came to power. And if it happened, which church would you be a member of? I've been reading the story of the Nazi persecution of the churches in Germany in the 1930s. And it was really extraordinary the way in which fine Christian men were deceived by Hitler. Even a man of the stature of Pastor Niemüller sent a telegram of congratulations to Hitler when he came to power. Of course, he saw his mistake later. And Dietrich Bonhoeffer also took a stand, and as perhaps you know, was executed 3 or 4 days before the end of the war. Very sad. A united church might have stopped Hitler in his tracks, but once in power, he edged the church slowly but surely back into the cloisters, supporting those who were still prepared to support him, and isolating the minority and all who refused to compromise their Christian position. In the 1920s, Germans lived in a democracy with freedom of speech, but they did not use that freedom of speech to condemn the rising nationalism and racialism of the day, and the violence against innocent people and against the Jews in particular was wrong and should have been roundly condemned, but they stayed silent. Hitler promised a moral resurgence, and they wanted a moral resurgence. He promised to throw over the Versailles Treaty, the consequences of which they had suffered along with every other German. Hitler promised strong rule, and after the economic chaos of the 20s, they felt the need for strong rule. But it now appears that even a little protest from the Christian public would have gone a long way, for Hitler was as responsive to public opinion as any other politician. He was extremely anxious to present a public front of national unity, and he was very conscious that he could not do this if he roused the opposition of the churches. And many of the Christians compromised themselves with Hitler to stay alive. And people like Dietrich Bonhoeffer wouldn't compromise, and they were executed. The temptation in secular history is to compromise your position. And lastly, the challenge is to take sides. The people who know their God, verse 32, shall stand firm and take action. Are you prepared to become a soldier of Jesus Christ? Or are you just a spectator? Do you have the tourist mentality? Tourists come, they gaze, they look, they admire, they disapprove, and they depart. Would you like to become a soldier of Christ? Or do you wish to go on being a tourist? Someone asked me what kind of society we'll be living in 20 years' time, or 30 years' time. Well, if Christ doesn't come, and if there is not an evangelical revival, I think society will look like this. There will be fewer and fewer churches. They're closing. Congregations are going to get smaller and smaller. I ask you, if all the unbelievers were put off the roll of the Church of Scotland, what do you think the membership of the Church of Scotland would be if the ungodly were removed from the membership rolls? They are not few. The number of baptisms will fall. It is falling rapidly. All weddings will take place in registry offices. And only the enthusiasts will be bothered going to church for a religious ceremony afterwards. And the number of atheist funerals, that's to say non-religious funerals for non-religious people, will grow. There will be no religious instruction in schools. Mercy, it's dying out already. And because there's no RI in schools, there will be no need for school chaplains. No religion will appear on the BBC or on television. Why do you broadcast religion if there's no public? Church buildings will be smaller. We'll have to sell this vast place. Church buildings will be smaller, but they'll be crowded. Church rolls will be purer. Who's going to be persecuted for a religion that doesn't mean very much to him? The Queen will not be crowned according to Christian ceremony. And society will become a grey place, like Eastern Europe. And we'll probably be ruled by middle-aged boors. Grey little political men. In other words, we're going to go back to the book of Acts, where Christians were Christians and unbelievers were unbelievers, and where the church was a persecuted minority and you had to take sides. The people who know their God shall stand firm and take action. Choose ye this day whom ye will serve, says the Old Testament. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. There was compromise in the camp in Moses' day. So he stood at the door of the tent and he called, "Who is on the Lord's side? Let him come out and follow me." The people that know their God shall stand firm and take action. That's the call in secular history, to hoist the flag for Christ and be a soldier of the Lamb. I ask you, are you prepared to do it? Amen. May God add his blessing to his word.